Hello, everyone. This is Andrew. Welcome to Keen on America. On July 4th, 2026, America will be 250 years old, an anniversary that will, no doubt, be greeted with a mixture of celebration, contemplation, and resignation. In Keen on America, we talk to prominent U.S. citizens, not just about their country's past and present, but also about its future. What, I ask my American guests, will be the 21st century fate of their now venerable republic? Arlie Russell Hochschild is one of America's leading sociologists, best known perhaps for her brilliant book about America, Strangers in Their Own Land. So I began our conversation with Arlie by asking her where and when in America she was born.
Hi, I'm Arlie Hochschild. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1940.
And what does being an American mean to her, I asked?
Well, it's the culture that I first imbibed and then had to think about and sometimes struggle with. And I consider it an act of loyalty, national loyalty, to tangle with the question of what it means to be an American, what America is in the world, policies it has internal to itself, to engage with those issues. I do so with that identity. Yeah.
I asked Arlie whether she felt she was lucky to be born an American.
Was I lucky to be born an American? Absolutely yes. That doesn't mean that I embrace everything that has come to seem American, but yes, I feel very fortunate. It, you know, whether the infrastructure I was born into, I could trust that the light would go on with the switch, and that the crops would be overrun. With the absence of water, there was an infrastructure that I didn't think twice about growing up. And then placed within that, you know, at a middle-class upbringing, which in the world puts me in sort of the upper class. Very, very lucky. Yeah.
Arlie's father was an American diplomat, so I asked her what it was like growing up as an American overseas.
Oh, it taught me a lot. When I was 12 years old, the family moved. My father had joined the Foreign Service, and we moved to, his job brought us to Israel, to Tel Aviv, so I went to a Scottish mission school in Jaffa, Israel. It was the only English-speaking school, and there I found myself a complete oddball. I was the only American there. I was a head taller than everyone. I had funny Oxford shoes. I didn't speak the language, didn't speak Hebrew, and so the playground, it's all foreign language, hour and a half at lunchtime. But quickly I got scooped up and made fast friends. And it taught me how tiny America is and how small within that country and the role of the United States. So, yeah, I came back transformed and realized what a big world it is and how rich America is. The kids that I went to school with, you know, they wore the same clothes all the time, you know, and they didn't have enough. I felt like I had too much. And I think that is a lesson I carry with me to this day.
Much of Arlie's childhood was spent in Israel, and I asked her whether she thought of America as a young country like Israel.
No, I didn't. I saw Israel as being a growing, young country. And I saw two sides of that as well. I can remember one time that my parents drove us to Jerusalem, where every so often Americans would cross over into Jordan and go shopping in the bazaar. And so I was sitting in the back seat eating pistachio nuts and just sort of dreaming. We get out of the car, went from the new city to the old city. And to go from the new city, the Israel side, to the Jordan side was to go from a kind of up-and-coming, positive building kind of Jerusalem to a kind of dilapidated, down-on-its-heels Jerusalem. And I remember one time that I got out of the... my dad parked the car in front of this bazaar. It's like this medieval kind of... looking kind of set of shops inside a walled area. And a lot of the Americans would go to the old city and shop there anyway. So I was tagging along with my parents there, and my dad parked the car. And in a parking lot outside this Kasbah, and so I got out with my sunflower seeds still in my hand, and I looked at some children that were lining around the parking lot, and I was utterly shocked. There were some children that lacked hair, that I guess, you know, the absence of vitamins, and there were blind children. There was a child that had no legs, who kind of moved himself along with his hands. There were wheels on his platform. And it was kind of shocking. They were beggars, you know, bakshish. And a man whose job it was to look after the cars came up to me and said, "I can see from your license plate, is your father a diplomat from Israel?" I said, "Yes." And then the man said to me, "Well, can you see how poor we are? America gives a lot of money to Israel, but why doesn't it give that much money to us in Jordan?" And I thought he had a good point. And I just tucked that away. I'm 12 years old. And I, on the way back in the car, I said, "Dad, you know, I talked to this guy, and he was pointing out how poor things are here. Why can't we help?" And he kind of said, "Well, that man might not have been just a parking attendant. He may have been, you know, trying to get to me through you. But you're right. There's a lot of poverty here, and it's terrible." So you have an experience like that when you're 12, and you just got a lot of questions, that there are in a way, you feel, as an American, they aren't quite questions upon you, but they're questions out there, and I think we're living with them today.
I asked her whether she ever encountered the same kind of poverty that she saw in Jordan in the United States.
You know, I did see the same kind of rural poverty when in 1964, my husband and I joined what was called Freedom Summer, and were part of a band of college kids that went down to Mississippi to work on voter registration. And I was a Freedom School teacher in Vicksburg, Mississippi. I saw a lot of poverty there too. So it's internally, in fact, you know, it might even be harder to be poor in a rich country than it is to be poor in a poor region.
As she began to learn about the history of the United States, I asked Ali whether she saw it as a burden or a celebration.
Yeah, well, one thing education does is show us the problems we've gotten into and problems we've caused. And hopefully it's pointed to the things we can do about them. That's where I get really interested. So I don't think we should shy away from focusing on the challenges that America faces, and currently the big split in the country. I don't think we should shy away from that. I think we need to lean into it and come to understand the standpoints from which people look and at the world, feel about the world.
How, I asked her, did she learn about the history of her own country?
Yes, well, you know, I remember in going earlier, when I was like 10 or 11, I was going to a public school in Silver Spring, Maryland, and there was something called the Weekly Reader, and it was actually a very conservative little thing you got every week. It was to teach children to read the newspaper, and so you would read the Weekly Reader. I guess it was four pages or something, but it talked about the terrible communist menace and the evils of Russia. And I remember going home and sort of imagining, oh, those terrible communists. I'd be a fighter against them, you know. It really sort of got me riled up and mad. And I think the other kids, too. Well, you know, I look back on that. Oh, no, what was that about? Was it talking about, it wasn't teaching me about problems and what could be done. It was just trying to get me mad from a right-wing point of view. So I began to look a little more closely at how I was being influenced by things I got actually out of in the classroom.
As she was growing up, I asked Ali, did she see that women were treated differently from men?
Oh yes, oh yes. I saw around me a world, and this was in the 1950s, in which men had work, constructed careers, and women took care of the family. That was my mother and father's story. And it was like big talk was something the men did, and small talk was something women did. And my mother was a highly intelligent homemaker, who actually was not happy. She fit into the feminine mystique. She loved my father. That was a good, loving marriage, but she didn't love her role as a woman in it. And she kind of wanted me to have something different, better than that. I didn't realize it at the time quite, but she was kind of pushing me in that direction, and it made sense to me to where I wanted to go.
As somebody who grew up in the 1950s, I asked Arlie whether she was surprised with the nostalgia that many Americans now seem to have for the supposedly halcyon 1950s.
I think it is. It's understandable because from the 1970s on, there have been new strains created in American culture with the globalization and offshoring of many jobs, automation out, widening class divide. All of that has made it harder on people. I think there's a reason for the nostalgia, in other words, and that while women like me have wanted to have meaningful work, and I think rightly so, but at the same time, what's been happening as we were growing up is that male wages were declining for most working families. So women went out to work, and when that didn't keep the family income in place, they worked. There's overtime work, so overworking. And then when that didn't work, I mean, people went into debt, and that became an issue. In other words, there was one private strategy after another to kind of keep level and to not have to sink down. And that's been a story that makes people nostalgic for the old days. They think they're nostalgic for the roles, but I think they're partly nostalgic for the absence of economic pressures upon average families to make do.
Arlie has had a glittering career as one of America's most distinguished and respected sociologists. So I asked her whether she felt that great sociologists are born or made.
No, it's not retreat, I think. I think I was born a sociologist. When I went to college, they didn't have it in my college. But when I read David Riesman's The Lonely Crowd's first book of sociology, I read, that's what I want to do. So it has called to me. What sociology provides for me is a perspective. It, apart from my own, it allows me to detach from my own life and try and see my own life in a larger framework. Like you have a camera here and you're looking, but you can change the lens, close up or distant. And for me, sociology is that lens.
So you think of yourself as a kind of camera on America?
Yes, I do. I do. And I like the long view, and then I like the really close-up view. And then I like to go back and forth between the long view and the close-up. That's a thrill for me.
And how, I asked Arlie, did her new tool of sociology, this thing that made sense of the world, how did it help her make sense of America?
Wow. I saw a problem with the role of women because as a grad student at Berkeley in sociology, there were no faculty ladder rank women professors. All the professors were male. There were lecturers that one woman taught statistics. She was a lecturer, but Otherwise, you saw women in the sociology department at Berkeley as the wives who would drive up in their camper trucks and kind of pick up their husbands for a, for an evening. So I kind of wondered, there's no place for people like us. About a third, maybe a quarter to a third of graduate students were women, and we were looking at each other. And then in 1962 is when I entered the sociology department as a graduate student, very fragile, very not quite sure I'd made the right decision. Seeing this after my first year, second year, we began to meet and turned into a women's caucus of fellow graduate students. I was an instructor, actually. It was a little later. I had become an instructor, and then we started the women's caucus that met in my tiny apartment on Virginia Street. And it was liberating to have a conversation, to use that sociological lens focusing on gender in our very department. And then we began to think, well, what is this? Let's put on the feminist lens. Are we learning concepts that are valuable for understanding the half of the population that are women? For example, social mobility, the way it was taught in our classes, had to do with the economic status of the man and whether it was superseded the man's father. So the American dream should be that a son, progresses and even out-earns his father. That was kind of you were asked to focus the lens on that. Well, is there any problem with that? Why does it have to be better, number one? Does an economy always have to grow, number two? Does it have to be a man, number three? And where are women in this story? So we sort of began in this caucus to reconceive of the American dream. It didn't have any care in it, didn't have any children in it, this picture. It was all economistic. It didn't have any non-economic realities in it. So it got very exciting and heady. I learned a lot of sociology by learning a sort of a counter-sociology, to get out the feminist lens. And then this was in the 1960s, and we became civil rights workers, and then race became the lens. What about the 13% of African Americans here? And why this regional gap, this social class gap? Where are the blacks in our university? And then it was the time of the Vietnam War, and where in our country's name we were dropping napalm on villagers in South Vietnam. We were mortified by that, and Adam and I were on many marches against the war, and then there was divestment, and we were marching against American investments in South Africa. My husband went down to South Africa, has written about it. So there were many lenses through which to look at America through the 1960s. I was very privileged to be part of it all.
Ali risked her life going down to Mississippi in the early 60s as a civil rights worker, and I asked her why she did this. She must have been pretty outraged.
In the civil rights movement was so I got really outraged to see what was happening in the South. And I hadn't really been fully aware of the huge, of segregation and all that preceded it, and lynchings, and not coming to terms with this whole horrific story of race in America, been underplayed and sort of not focused on. So, in 1964, it was kind of scary. There were beatings, and of course, in 64, there was the lynching of civil rights workers, three of them, the year that Adam and I went down. So you could say we were scared, others did far more. Others did far more, and our black co-workers got a much harder experience than we did.
What, I asked Ali, do sociologists make of dreams, particularly the so-called American dream?
I think the American dream, in a way, is a connection. It's an idea. It's an ideal. It's held up to us. And it's trying to connect our personal idea of pride, how you can come to feel really good about yourself, with, in a way, a capitalist economic system that wants you to kind of connect to it and wants you to buy its stuff. And I think there should be an American dream. I think they're kind of, but we need to really retool the American dream we got given. And for example, the idea, it's kind of built into the American dream that more and more and more is better. In other words, that economic growth, that's always good. Is it always good? I mean, we just want more plastic bags in the ocean. We want more throwaway stuff. In whose interest is that? Is that, and how about, so more isn't good or always better than how your dad did? No, that isn't always better if what your dad or mom had is good. So also, in other words, I'm not throwing away dreams. I think we need to fix our dreams. We need to green our dreams. We need to put care in our dreams. Are we caring for the earth? I mean, what have we done? I just had a conversation with a guy in Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, Pike County, part of a research project I just finished. And he said, you know, in back of my house, my wife and I noticed there are a lot of plastic cups and throwaway things, candy wrappers. It's as if we don't, and back of his house is a stream, and the stream has carried this. He said, you know, that here we live in a country, and we've got beautiful streams, but we don't make it part of our dream to take care of it, to appreciate it. We think of these streams as a place, as like you can leave your garbage. And there's an absence of love of place in a very place that's proud of loving its sense of place. And I think he was caught hold of a terribly important critique in a way that we all need to take to heart.
Did America become more honest with itself in the 1960s, I asked Arlie. Did its reality replace its appearance?
You know, the 60s is seen as an angry, discontented generation for people who were young growing up in it. I think of it as increasingly optimistic. Like, we really wanted our American dream to be a great thing. I just wanted to extend it to everyone that deserves it and to make it, refocus it on care of the planet and repair of anything that's broken. So I don't think of the 60s as angry and discontented. Okay, they can discontent, but in the honor of improving something. That feels to me actually positive.
I asked Arlie whether she felt she had a privileged front row seat on seeing what happened in the 1960s in America.
Problems. But, you know, in the 60s, we had the faith that we could work together on those problems and cooperatively on those problems. And that, I can't think of a better life than devoting yourself to fixing something broken. So it had a lot of meaning. And some people who are in their were brought up in the 60s, you know, I think it's transformed us for life. People who are in their 60s and 70s now are kind of highly engaged with the issues of the day. And I think there is, it's animated by a certain optimism that problems are fixable. I think that's a good thing.
I asked Arlie whether there was any truth in the conservative critique that everything that has gone wrong in America over the last 50 years can be traced back to what happened in the 1960s.
I don't think so. There was a kind of a, what sociologists call a loosening of social controls. There were many different 60s, and the 60s I was part of, I wouldn't describe that way, and I wouldn't describe integrating the sociology department as a loss of social control or a out-of-it kind of thing. I experienced it as getting women into the game of trying to make a better world.
And then, of course, there was Vietnam. What impact did this catastrophic war have on Arlie, I asked.
Yes, I would say I felt really strongly, for the first time this strongly, that the U.S., was really on the wrong side, was doing damage. Nobody had, this wasn't a good thing. Nothing about it was good. It was imperial. It was, there was a book written by Jonathan Schelk, it was about this tiny town in Vietnam, the village of Ben Suk, and how Americans, soldiers had told all the people that lived there to move, and then it bombed it again deeper. And he's asking in this book, why do that? And his answer was, again, he moved the lens way back. He said, well, you know, we've created the atom bomb. We can destroy the world with that. But we don't dare use them. We've got an instrument that's so horrible we can't use it. So instead, we've kind of displaced that desire to express power and dominance and control in one place and just go deeper, destroy that one place more. And he's pointed to the sheer irrationality of that. Here's where we need psychology. Why do that, you know? Why not think about displacement rather than just displacement? And it was very haunting, and we felt responsible for some of the photographs we saw. There was one after napalm, a very famous photograph of a young girl whose clothing had been burned off, and she's running and screaming, and she became the face of the horror that America was bringing to otherwise small country. So, yeah, a lot of work to do to make one, to be a proud American. You had to really look at all America was doing.
Apart from other professional sociologists, I asked Arlie, who did she look to in the 1960s for moral guidance?
Well, John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and in the civil rights movement, Bob Moses, Robert Moses, who was a math teacher, and he led, down in Atlanta, Mississippi, where we were trained to go to the various towns we were working in 1964. Bob Moses was a very kind of quiet, spoken, serious, African-American teacher, and he spoke with such quiet dignity that both of us were just very moved and inspired by him. And so I was inspired by a lot of people, but I would pick out Bob Moses as kind of the main one, just by his quietness and what showed through that quietness was a fierce sense of purpose. And one saw it in Kennedy also. Later in other movements, Betty Friedan, I suppose, and Martin Luther King, who had both a reach out. He wasn't saying, well, this is a movement just for us people, or you whites can't participate, which was a moment of that after the 64, when whites were disinvited. And that was a sad moment, because I think it was a misstep, because I think we need everybody in this game. But King really, really had a large vision, and he spoke out very forcefully against the war in Vietnam.
In 2024, I asked Arlie, what can we learn from some of the leaders of the 1960s?
We can learn to recognize the local leaders that are very strong around us today on the issues that we have today. I see a lot of potential leaders. I don't see a culture that they can easily appeal to. I think there is a kind of a demobilization on the progressive left side that concerns me a lot. But I think potential leaders are actually there. We had a gathering in our living room not long ago. It's a guy named Saket Soni who was there. And just to give you a kind of an idea of the things going on, he went around the South and in Walmart parking lots and saw a lot of undocumented workers. And he got to talking to them, just talking to these Indians. He went right up to them. Some of them undocumented workers were Indians. And they said, you know, actually our passports have been taken away from us, our documents such as they are, and our money, we're not being paid, we're actually slave laborers. And he got a lawyer and got the company that had was actually enslaving these workers, got that company sued, won the suit, and then he organized these undocumented workers who were working in this company to rebuild houses that had been torn down by hurricanes in the South. Okay, so they were doing necessary work that nobody else was doing. And so and they knew how to do it. And so he got them little tags, you know, I'm a specialist in roofing. When roofs blow off in big storms, of which there are more and more. And these, he also encouraged these workers to talk to the homeowners that they were helping and who were often very against immigration, and some really interesting conversations developed. Anyway, this guy, Saket Soni, was in the meeting. There was everybody in this meeting that was doing something interesting like that. I think that's the spirit of the 60s. And 2024, and I applaud it. Different issues, but same spirit.
I asked Ali whether there was any truth in the progressive critique these days that the left in the 1960s lost touch with the American white working class.
I think we have drifted away from a focus on class, paradoxically, just as social classes become more important than it ever, it has been in 100 years. And actually my current work is focused on that division, because from the 70s on, you had the winners and the losers of globalization. And the winners were people in urban areas where there were companies that were really pretty immune to automation and offshoring, and the high level of education and opportunity. That turned out to be the blue states. And then you had the losers of globalization. And they were living in areas where the places of work were more vulnerable to automation and offshoring. And they would be in rural or semi-rural areas, population more blue-collar. So you had these winners and losers. And then politics became draped over that. And curiously, in my day, to be a Democrat, you thought you were being for the working people and the the poor, and that was right. Well, it's kind of turned around. And a lot of people who are Democrat or progressive have not kept their eye, I think. The movement has not kept its eye on that social class gap. So I don't think that the right has the answers to that social class gap. I think the people with the answers aren't really focused on the problem.
I asked Arlie whether she felt that progressives in the 1960s became a little too preoccupied with the politics of cultural identity.
Well, there's got to be a way to simultaneously make progress on race and on sexual identity while also making progress on decreasing the gap between the rich and the poor and listening keenly to those who are downly mobile rather than turning a deaf ear to it because you're in a sector that's upwardly mobile. So I understand if a lot of working class people feel forgotten by the quote left. I think they have been forgotten, and that's a major issue. And we need to reconnect on that issue.
I asked Dali, as she looked back over American history, whether she saw moments when the white and the black working classes were united.
It's interesting. Yes, certainly the 60s brings to mind a period of whites and blacks and poor and rich working together for a common goal. And that is an ideal I want to see increasingly realized and recognized as an ideal. And we feel all split off at the moment from that goal. It's funny, in my field work recently in Eastern Kentucky, I was reminded of the song, "Which Side Are You On?" Boys, which side are you on? And it began, that song, by legend, actually the melody, as a black lullaby, that the melody was a lullaby to put a child to sleep. But that lullaby was then used by the widow of a slain union organizer in Harlan, Kentucky, who was working with the United Coal Miners Union and who was slain by a company man. And so, which side are you on? Which side are you on? Are you a union man who, you know, working for a better day, a better wage, or not? And then that same song was used in the civil rights movement. You know, which side are you on? To me, that's very, very moving. And sometimes we need to look at lyrics to make the connections between one struggle in one period of time and another struggle in another period of time.
Arlie is best known for her book, Strangers in Their Own Land. And I asked her whether she ever felt like a stranger in her own land, whether she felt a stranger in America.
I often felt like a stranger in my own land, and now I feel like progressives are increasingly feeling like strangers in our own land. Talking to you here in March of 2024, there is a sense of strangeness in our culture, I feel. So when I went down to get to know people in Louisiana in the years leading up to the 2016 election, I felt like they felt like they were the strangers in their own land. And that's what they told me that they felt. And I felt like I was looking at people who felt marginalized and were in a kind of declining area of the country and were looked down on for that, and who were upset at that. And I wanted to communicate that back to the rest of my readership, wherever they were. Hey, we should do something about this. There are good answers to the real problems they have, and there are bad answers to the real problems they have. And we're facing with a bad answer. Basically, what I feel is that the country has split into two, and they are the winners and the losers of globalization. And the losers have become embittered, and the first thing to feel bad about is that we didn't have a really good answer when globalization drained jobs out of small towns of America. And we didn't answer that. That's problem one. And then a bad answer came in. So I'll make you feel good, but I'm not going to really solve your problems. I'm going to blame other people. I'm going to blame blacks. I'm going to blame immigrants. I'm going to blame gays. That's a bad answer to a real problem. And we're feeling bad about not being able to counter that bad answer. So now we've got two problems. There weren't original answers to it, and now there's no answer to the bad answer to it. And so our sources of discouragement are stacking up. But if there's one thing I really feel is true about being an American, is that you don't give up when bad answers stack up. What you do is focus on it, get together with others and address it, fight it. You know, one person once said, climate change is just such a big problem, and what can I as one person do about it? And another said, there's this thermodynamic reaction from the right, it's so strong, what can I as one person do about it? And the answer was, don't be one person, join a group.
Ollie made two significant journeys in her own life. The first was as a young civil rights activist to the American South in the early 1960s. And then 50 years later, she returned to the South to write her book, Strangers in Their Own Land. I asked her whether there was any symmetry between these two journeys.
Symmetry. Yeah, you could say that I'm a person who focuses on problems, like most sociologists, I think, what I conceive of as a problem. And I say that humbly, not by saying, you're the problem, but I like to go to where there's a problem. And in both cases, that's what drew me to the South. The first time, what drew me to the South was racism. That was the problem. And the second time it drew me to the South was what I thought of as a fake answer to the problems that people in the South, whites in the South, have, that have racism mixed in as well. So, what I came away with after writing Strangers in Rome Land was a deep respect for the people who I met, who felt kind of like a minority themselves, and I didn't feel recognized for it. I tried hard to make them feel, look, I do see who you are, but I don't see the solutions the way you see the solutions. And there has to be a bridge between people like you and people like me. And we are different, but bridges are possible. And if we're going to be a nation in America, we've really got to talk respectfully across those lines. Now, you can say that building empathy bridges isn't the way to go, that this is a war and we better put on our gloves, get our guns out. I am not of that opinion. I think the issues could not be more serious and the differences more important. But that's why I think we've got to get creative about being the Nelson Mandelas of our generation and our place on the earth. I mean, if you look at what Nelson Mandela did, people thought this country's going to tear itself apart. It'll bust. It'll just blow up. It'll be a bloodbath. But that isn't what Nelson Mandela thought. And it wasn't that he was building an empathy bridge, but he wasn't doing it blind. He wasn't doing it to be soft. He was a warrior, but he did it empathically. And actually, he knew Afrikaans. He talked to the enemy in their language. I think that's extraordinary, and he's really my top hero. And that he laid out some methods that we need to learn from.
Given all her talk about empathy bridges, I asked Ali whether she thought that the business of sociology was akin to the business of marriage counseling.
You might say that those of us who are interested in building empathy bridges are marriage counselors. And you might even say that we're therapists, but not of individuals, not of families, but of social groups. And that's a lens, an emotional lens, where you're really looking at the social structuring of pride, the social structuring of shame, the importance of fear and anger. Those are psychological questions, but they, I think, have answers for us and are a lens that help us illuminate the realities in social life. So yeah, we need therapy for the world.
So should politicians in 2024, I asked Ali, be trying to build empathy bridges?
I think we do need therapy leaders, and I do see them in Martin Luther King, in Nelson Mandela. And in our day, I would take a look at, hang on just a minute, what's his name? I would take a look at Governor Bashir of Kentucky, right there in the middle of America, a Democratic governor in a Republican state. And what's he doing right? I think what he's doing right is being no false promises, but very straight across, respectful. He saw people through the pandemic by saying, look, we don't have all the answers. We don't know exactly how to cure this thing. We just don't want people to die. Here's what the experts are telling us. Let's give that a try, real try. We're Team Kentucky. He kept talking about Team Kentucky. And every Friday, every 5 o'clock, you know, you would tune in and there would be Andy Bashir, Team Kentucky. And he became the most popular governor in the country. And he did it not by playing to people's desire for relief from shame, their anger, their desire for revenge at being shamed. He didn't go that way. He was like a therapist. How can we make this thing work? You know, and I think he's a good model today. He's not coastal. You know, he's right in the middle of the country. And speaking plainly to people who feel respected by him, that's the way to go.
But didn't Bill Clinton promise to build bridges, I suggested to Ali, and wasn't he a huge failure in the 1990s?
I think Clinton was a success in his style. He felt, you know, down home. He's our guy. I think he ushered in a very right-wing policies on welfare and on prisons, three strikes. So that's no reason to give up on his down-home popular appeal style. The thing to learn from Clinton is how to deliver better policies. He's good on the how to deliver, not so good on the policies.
So what if we don't succeed in building empathy bridges? I asked Ali. Then what? What becomes of America?
You know, I kind of am not interested in that question. What, you know, if we go down, I think it's better to focus on how to go up and not feed into a pessimism. And, you know, in the course of my research in Kentucky for my new book, Stolen Pride, I met a guy who had just emerged from recovery program after 12 years of heroin addiction. And he was just telling me, at the time he had a big bandana around his face, an earring, and he said, you know, I've come out of a bad addiction, and in my recovery I realized that actually addiction is a feeling and thinking disease. It's you take a pill when you shoot up when you don't know quite how to think or feel, or you're afraid of your feelings. And he said, now that I'm in recovery, I feel 4 years old. What's awe? What's love? What's envy? I'm learning now those feelings again. He said, I was in my truck and I had to pull over because I saw a beautiful sunset. And I had to weep at the beauty of the sunset. And then I went back, and that night I was talking to my sponsor, Narcotics Anonymous sponsor, and he said, James, that's awe. And then he said, you know, I think we all need to relearn our feelings. That, you know, maybe the nation itself on both sides of this big split need to kind of humbly rethink what it is that makes us, ticks us off so quickly, and what it is that makes us frightened and or resentful, that would be good. Now, 4 years after I met this man, he is himself a counselor, helping others recover, the last time I talked to him, and this is the last word of my book, he was appointed to be the director of the program in recovery.
In July of 2026, America will be 250 years old. Is this a birthday, I asked Arlie, that should be celebrated?
It should be celebrating the part of America that is self-repairing. And I think we need to repair the apparatus of repair. But, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville talked about the American character in Democracy in America and referred to a kind of a down-to-earth pragmatism of Americans. You know, if the car is broke, you know, you get your neighbors, you fix it. And that there is that on the ground, no nonsense, a kind of desire to help and to repair. And I think that should be our basis of pride. Not getting, you know, a yacht or, you know, live in some castle, but being a good neighbor, a good worker, retooling the American dream so that they were looking at the basic original virtues of America and seeing that part of it is fixing things that are broke. And one thing that can get broke is the whole class system.
And what about the long-term future of America? In 50 years' time, in 2076, I asked Arlie, what kind of country would she like America to become?
That's a wonderful question. I'd love to see a whole new, more unified America, and one that looked to a renewed American ideal, and for that to look actually to, I think, Scandinavia, where I see a kind of some wonderful models in how to deal with people who end up in prison. In fact, to get people out of prison, to reduce that population and get people who've fallen down back on their feet. I think Finland is kind of the model, both. And I think the key is that reform becomes a really proud thing to do, that you're proud to have recovered after having fallen down. And the same thing with workers. You know, if we look in Germany, workers, blue-collar workers, are given more respect. And actually, the original, there's a, in the German language, that you are master apprentice. There's a kind of a, you may be working with your hands, but that's just as important as working with your mind. And your mind is telling your hands what to do. And when firms look to automate, there are blue-collar workers on the committees that are looking at how that would work out. So part of what I would like to see in the future is more empowerment of blue-collar workers of every race, and a kind of a lower ceiling and higher floor to our social class system, then I think we could get community going. I mean, the real basis of what makes people happy is connection to other human beings and to feel proudly contributing to that community. The more we get that happening, the better. And that's what I want to see when I'm long gone. I'm hoping that that's what's ahead. And they're working toward that goal is what's ahead.